You're listening to Really? Miracles? By Steve Tsai. Steve is a staff apologist at apologetics.com in the United States. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 9th, 2013 at Northview Community Church.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and get started. Just to let you know, this is going to be challenging. I try my best to simplify as best as I can, but honestly, at this point, if you want something less challenging, no problem at all. There's a lot of other seminars. I'm totally fine with that. I'll simplify this as best as I can. But we're talking philosophy, especially a lot about a particular philosopher. It's going to be sometimes a little challenging. And I teach philosophy at undergrad at Azusa Pacific University. It's a university in California. And luckily, they have the benefit, though, of having a whole class with me. And then three-fourths of the way we get to this stuff. But they have the background, and I understand you guys don't. Can you follow this? Yes. But it's going to take a lot of concentration. So feel free. I'll just turn my back. And if you guys... No problem, honestly. I might do that in your position too, but all right, you're gonna have to put your thinking caps on. Like I said, I'll try my best to simplify this as best as I can. But the nice thing about this, though, is the guy we're gonna talk about. His name is David Hume. He gave what many people consider the strongest arguments against miracles in Western thought. So when you have skeptics arguing against, for example, the possibility of miracles, that miracles are impossible, or against the credibility of miracles, that we should never believe them, even if they do happen. They're so incredible. We, as rational people, should never believe them. They're getting their stuff from Hume. It's all recycled Hume. So that's the nice thing when you go to the primary sources for things. A lot of times you get the strongest arguments, but also your refutations are the strongest as well. Okay. So let's give this a shot. So let me quote Hume to start off. Here's what Hume says about his arguments against miracles. He says, "I flatter myself that I have discovered an argument which, if just, will, with the wise and learned, be an everlasting check to all kinds of superstitious delusion, and consequently will be useful as long as the world endures." So what is this superstitious delusion? Miracles. The supernatural. God intervening in human affairs. Whether that's stories of God with regard to Christianity, or even other types of religions. Note the Greek gods, they always intervened in human affairs, right? Things like this. So Hume considers the arguments he's going to give an everlasting check to all those kinds of superstition. So this is what we're looking at today. Now Hume has two primary arguments. The first, I'm just going to call his violation argument, okay? And after hearing it, you might feel a little violated, but I can't do anything about that. What is it? It's the idea that a miracle is a violation of a law of nature. Therefore, it can't happen, because natural law can't be violated. It can never be violated. What we understand as natural law is they cannot be violated. So if a miracle is a violation of something that can't be violated, they're impossible. In principle, they're impossible. Now, his next argument, though, is a much more sophisticated argument. And it argues not for the impossibility of miracles, but for their incredibility. Meaning, even if we had the strongest case that they actually did occur, we shouldn't believe them, because they're way too incredible. So even if we do have, quote-unquote, good evidence, so to speak, that they did occur, we shouldn't believe it. Once again, they're way too incredible. Right? It's like, it'd be like pigs flying or something like this. We would never believe that, right? Because they just don't do that. It's too incredible. The same way, someone rising from the dead? Yeah, right. How many funerals have we been to, all of us combined, and we've never seen anything like that, right? So when we hear a story of something like that, of course it can't be true. It's way too incredible. So the first deals with the possibility of miracles. The second deals with the justification for miracles, or should we believe in them? So let's talk about both. So what I like to do typically is give the skeleton of the argument, and then from there we proceed to kind of put some flesh on the bones. So let me give you the skeleton of Hume's argument. Firstly, miracles are a violation of natural law. So this is Hume's definition of a miracle. What is a miracle? Violation. That's what it is. Second, but natural law cannot be violated. And I'm going to quote Hume, but he talks about firm and unalterable experience. That's where we get natural laws from. Firm and unalterable experience. Therefore, miracles cannot occur. So once again, the first argues for miracles' impossibility. And what we're going to get to argues for miracles' incredibility. So let me quote Hume again. And by the way, if you guys email me, steve@apologetics.com, I'll send you a link and you guys can get the PowerPoint. So don't feel like you're going to miss anything. Okay? Just try your best to follow along with me. It should be good. So here's what Hume says. A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. And as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. So for Hume, what is a natural law? It's a description of firm and unalterable experience. So he brings the two together. Okay? So here's one example of firm and unalterable experience. When people die, they stay dead. How many billions upon billions upon billions of testimony do we have of people staying dead when they die, right, throughout human history? How many reports of resurrections do we have? Not even investigating that. How many claims do we have of resurrections compared to the testimony of people staying dead? You know, the scales are tipped, right, hugely. And note here, just make a distinction between resuscitation and resurrection. Resuscitation is no big deal, right? Many of the cells are still living, if not most of the cells are still living in your body if someone resuscitates you. Resurrection, though, is different. You are decomposing at that point. So when Jesus raises Lazarus, he's in the tomb for days, right? It's not a resuscitation. It's a resurrection. So this is what I mean when people die, they stay dead. We're not talking about resuscitations or anything like this. Talking more along the lines of Lazarus. Someone starting to decompose. Remember, there's a smell in the tomb. And then, allegedly, Jesus resurrected him. So, instances like that. So, given human experience has established this fact, what fact? That people, when they die, they stay dead. How can this firm and unalterable experience be altered or violated? Right? A resurrection claim violates this firm and unalterable experience we have of people dying and staying dead. And once again, look at the amount of testimony we have of people dying and staying dead from all of humanity. Right? The scales are tipped so much. Given this, miracles cannot occur. Resurrections cannot occur. They violate firm and unalterable experience. They violate the uniform testimony of humanity, right? That a resurrection occurs. So, they can't. Violations can't occur. So now let me talk about a few criticisms with this view. Now I'm going to talk about a certain fallacy. And it's not the easiest to get up front. If you guys get it, I applaud you. But you're going to have to think about this a little bit. And that's okay. If a lot of this you have to go through again, that's fine. Okay? But here it is. This is a mistake in reasoning. Okay, it's not a good thing, it's a bad thing. When you do this, it's a bad thing. It's called circularity or begging the question. When you hear people say this term, oh, he begged the question. Right, she begged the question. They're referring to this. Okay, what is circularity or begging the question? It's assuming an answer to the thing in question when it can be avoided, or presupposing that which is to be proven. Circularity, strictly speaking, isn't about an argument that keeps on going back and forth, and no one ever wins. It has nothing to do with circularity. Okay, it'd be like me saying something like, Well, Steve Tsai is the greatest professor in the world. And you ask, well, how do you know that? because Steve Tsai said he's the best professor in the world. Well, you know, why should you believe what Steve Tsai says? Because Steve Tsai is the greatest professor in the world, and he wouldn't lie. See, there's things are recycling. Premises are recycling. And strictly speaking, you can't do that in an argument. Remember the three premises I gave? All of them are different. You can't recycle them. So another way to think about this is you can't smuggle in the conclusion into your premises somewhere. Now let me give you an example through a movie clip. How many of you guys have seen Inception? Okay. This is the best example I can give of this. Like I said, it's challenging, but I think you guys can get it. So let me just show you a short clip.
You'll need a totem.
What?
A totem. It's a small
person. So subconscious you've got to become. She's a real charmer.
Oh.
See,
you met Mrs. Khan.
She's his wife.
Yeah. So a totem. You need a small object, potentially heavy, something you can have on you all the time that no one else
like
knows.
Like a coin?
No. This is a loaded bag. I can't let you touch it. That would defeat the purpose. See, only I know the balance and the weight of this particular loaded die. That way, when you look at your totem, you know beyond a doubt that you're not in someone else's dream.
Okay. So just to summarize, who can summarize? What's the point of a totem in this movie? Who can summarize? What's the point?
It's a reality check.
Okay, go ahead.
You see.
But what does it do? What does it give you?
Tells you whether you're dreaming or in reality.
Okay. Good. Close to that.
You know what it's supposed to be every time.
Good.
Yes.
So, good. In general, it's attempting to distinguish between dreaming and reality. Now, specifically in this movie, they make it a point that your totem tells you whether or not you're in someone else's dream. Right? Because if, according to this movie, if I can pull you into my dream and I can construct all sorts of things going on, maybe I can extract secrets from you and things like this. So this is what they try to do. They, you know, pull people into their dreams. So to know that you're not in someone else's dream and you're not being manipulated by someone else, you create this totem. Well, what's that? It's this thing that has a unique feel to it that only you would know. So he mentions a loaded die, right? Well, what's unique about it? It's the weight. It's the feel. Notice, if I pull you into my dream, I can replicate the look of a die, but I can't replicate the feel of it, right? Because I don't know how it feels. And instantly, you'll know I'm not in reality or I'm not in my own dream. Someone's manipulating me because they don't know how my die feels, but I do, right? So that's the point of this totem. To let you know you're not in someone else's dream being manipulated, right? Because you know how it feels. No one else does. Once again, they can manipulate the look, but not the feel. That's why he wouldn't let that girl touch it. Only he knows how it feels. So let me just schematize this in argument form. So what's the claim here? And whenever I look at arguments with my students, I do a three-part analysis of an argument. Firstly is, what's the claim? My totem allows me to distinguish whether or not I'm in someone else's dream. Right? I don't want people pulling me in and manipulating me and doing all sorts of things and making me give up my secrets. I'll keep my secrets. All right. So this is what a totem allows you to do. Now, who can see a problem with this? What's a problem with this whole totem thing and what it's supposed to give you? What's a problem with the whole idea of a totem? Who can see that? Why would it be problematic? What do you guys think? What do you mean?
You're still trying to distinguish from two unconscious positions.
What do you mean? Give me. Okay. All right. So actually, if you're in your dream, that's okay, because no one manipulating me in my dream, right? And that's why I remember how it feels. So that's no problem. The problem is I'm in someone else's dream, and like I said, they're trying to extract secrets or something like that. So who else? Who can see a problem with this idea? Go ahead. Yeah. So in this, you're able to tell it's your totem, because, like I said, there's a certain feel it has, and you don't let anyone else touch it. So, yeah. Okay. Who can see the problem with this? So. What do you need to do to create a totem? Well, you need to create a totem, right? Well, where do you create a totem? where would you want to create a totem? Let's say there's three possible places: your dream, reality, or someone else's dream. Where would you want to create a totem?
Reality.
Reality. Good. And you don't want to create it in someone else's dream, right? Because that's the whole point. That destroyed the whole point. But given that, how do you know you created your totem not in someone else's dream? How do you know you created your totem in reality? Right? Yeah, you don't. The totem only works if I know right now this isn't a dream and I start creating my totem. How do I know that, though? How do I know right now isn't a dream? Like someone hasn't already pulled me in. See, I need knowledge of that in the first place to even make a totem. I need to know, no, this is reality. This is a safe place to make it. I'm not in anyone else's dream. Got it. I make it. But that's the question to begin with. A totem is supposed to tell you that you're not in someone else's dream. Right? So this is begging the question. This whole thing is begging the question. I already have to know I'm not in someone else's dream to make a totem. But that's what a totem is supposed to tell me. See? This begs the question. A totem wouldn't work unless I already knew that this isn't someone else's dream. This is reality. But that's what a totem is supposed to tell me. So the thing is, I don't need a totem if I create a totem, right? It's unnecessary. Because I know this is reality. It's safe to create it right now. Okay. So this begs the question. This is circular. This whole idea of a totem doesn't work. So you might want to think about this, you know, watch the movie again, whatever. It doesn't work. You already have to know you're not in someone else's dream. But that's what it was supposed to tell you. What's the point? If I already have to know that, why create a totem in the first place? Okay. So this is an example of begging the question. Like I said, it's a little sophisticated. Just think about it for a little bit. And think about this example, and you'll see why it doesn't work, why this whole totem idea doesn't get you anywhere. Well, back to Hume. Let's relate this back to Hume. So let me quote Hume again. He says, "It is no miracle that a man seemingly in good health should die on a sudden, because such a kind of death has yet been frequently observed to happen. But it is a miracle that a dead man should come to life, because that has never been observed in any age or country. It is more probable that all men must die." Now, who can see an issue with this part, the idea that someone's dying and rising has never been observed in any age or country? So this is one of Hume's arguments against miracles. We've never observed it. What's problematic about that?
Well, the resurrection
is
actual history.
Good. And someone else is going to say something? It begs the question, right? You might think, well, wait a second, what about the resurrection accounts, right? And what Hume is going to say is that doesn't count as observation. So what counts as observation? Oh, when people stay dead. Okay. So, see, he's kind of loading things in his favor, so to speak, right? What counts as observation? This naturalistic perspective that people stay dead. Right? And so if it doesn't comport with that, it doesn't even count as observation. This is why he says never been observed. Because what counts as observation is people dying and staying dead. That begs the question. Wait a second, why don't you even consider the possibility that the resurrection accounts are evidence? Why don't you even consider that a possibility? Because once again, he begs the question. He just assumes naturalism is the case. He assumes there is no God, that supernatural things don't exist. He just assumes that from the start. And then he picks and chooses certain portions of evidence. He likes this one. Oh, someone dying and staying dead. Oh, someone dying and staying dead. He sees resurrection. Someone's dying and staying dead. Resurrection. And he keeps on picking only certain experiences and counts those as evidence. Right? Once again, this is begging the question. And let me quote C.S. Lewis. He had a great answer to this. Here's what he says. "Now, of course, we must agree with Hume that if there is absolutely uniform experience against miracles, if, in other words, they have never happened, why then they never have. Unfortunately, we know the experience against them to be uniform only if we know that all the reports of them are false. And we can know all the reports to be false only if we know already that miracles have never occurred. In fact, we are arguing in a circle, right? So this is the criticism, right? What counts as evidence? People dying and staying dead. Well, of course, you're going to get your conclusion if that's all that counts as evidence, right? Notice, if you pick and choose evidence, you can prove anything. If I can pick and choose what counts as evidence, any particular thing, let's say aliens existing, something like this. If I can pick and choose what counts as evidence, and everyone contrary, I don't count them as evidence, I can prove anything. I can prove aliens exist. We have all this surmounting evidence that aliens exist, right? I take all the testimony from people, all their arguments and everything, and I ignore all the counterarguments. I ignore all the criticisms, right? So his method, once again, begs the question. Same thing I would be doing in the alien case, only counting pro-alien evidence, begging the question, assuming in advance an answer to the question. I'm assuming in advance aliens exist. That's why I'm picking and choosing the evidence. Let's talk about this now. Let me fast forward a little bit. Now let's transition to not the impossibility of miracles, so to speak, but their incredibility. Okay? Now there's more to be said with regard to the impossibility of miracles. You guys can look that up. There are great refutations given by good Christians. There are refutations given by non-Christians as well. One great book is called Hume's Abject Failure. Okay? Pretty strong title. It's written by a non-Christian. Okay, so, and he says in the beginning, I'm not a Christian apologist or anything like this, but I think Hume's arguments against miracles stink. And he says, I don't believe in the Christian God. If I were to believe in God, he says, I kind of like the Roman gods. But that's besides the point. So it's not just that Christians have seen, you know, holes in Hume's thinking, but many non-Christians as well. But here's an interesting quote from Hume. Basically, what he's saying here is that if Queen Elizabeth was resurrected and all historians of the particular time said that she did, they all attested to it, and she ruled not for like, you know, a split second or something like this, but for 3 years, people saw her for 3 years ruling and such. You have all these historians that say that she did, in fact, rise from the dead. He says he still wouldn't believe it. It's too incredible. Why? What's he comparing it to? Well, the testimony of humanity. What's that? Through all human beings, right? People die, they stay dead. This isn't that impressive once you consider the weight of all the evidence for people dying and staying dead. For all of humanity, this little evidence that you have of a few historians and a few people saying Queen Elizabeth rose from the dead, nothing compared to the uniform testimony of humanity that when people die, they stay dead. So this is a more subtle argument. So let me give the premises of this argument. And a lot of arguments start with premises that are very non-controversial, and eventually they build and build, and you get to that controversial part at the end. So, first, a miracle is by definition a rare occurrence. Okay? Resurrections don't happen that often. I'm fine with that. Two, natural law is by definition a description of a regular occurrence. Sure. Take laws of gravity, things like this. Okay, no problem. Three, the evidence for the regular is always numerically greater than that for the rare. Sounds about right. I really have no issue with this at all. But Hume is building very gradually. What's the next premise? Wise individuals should always base their beliefs on the numerically greater evidence. Now, this is the controversial premise. Wise individuals should always base their beliefs on the numerically greater evidence. Once again, prima facie at first glance, you might think, well, okay, I can kind of agree to that. But if you follow his line of reasoning, you get five. Therefore, wise individuals should never believe in the improbable, like miracles. Right? Because a miracle is by definition rare. It's not regular. By definition, you have less evidence for it than the regular. What does a wise man do? Bases evidence on what's probable. That is the numerically greater evidence. What's that? People stay dead. They don't rise. Okay? So this, once again, is talking about the incredibility of miracles. Even if in principle, they could happen. You should never believe them, and I should never believe them. Too incredible. We should base our beliefs on what's probable. And what's probable? When people die, they stay dead. So let's look at this one. As I mentioned, premise four, this is pretty much the one that we need to, as a Christian, contend against. If Hume doesn't have all four premises, he can't get his conclusion. We knock out one, that's good enough. So this is the contentious premise. All the rest I can agree to, I have no issue with. But let's look at this. So, what is Hume arguing? Probabilistically. What should we base our beliefs on? The more probable. What's more probable? Someone rising from the dead or someone staying dead? Someone staying dead. Even if you believe in miracles, you would admit the same thing. People usually stay dead. Lazarus doesn't happen that much. Jesus doesn't happen that much. Right? Therefore, you base your evidence that people stay dead, that they don't rise. Because that's the more probable. But let me ask you this. Are there instances in which we're justified in believing in something extremely improbable? Are there instances?
What?
Before man was able to fly, probably you would agree with most people that man will never fly.
Mm-hmm.
The Wright brothers started doing it. Not everyone in the world would have known about that, but most people in Calvin agree that it was impossible for man to fly.
Good. The uniform testimony of humanity is man is not able to fly, aided or unaided. So we'll talk about that. That's a good point. Good. Who can think of anything else? Going to the moon? Good. Another example of something that quite rare, right? On Hume's view, would seem improbable. It's not like all of us go to the moon very often, right? Good. Examples like this, and I'll talk about those as well. Here's one, an interesting one. This deals with just probability. Take any lottery, whatever the string of numbers happens to be. This is Mega Millions. Do you guys have this? Mega Millions? Like that? Do you have lotteries? Okay, cool. Well, you pick numbers between 1 and 56 five times, and then you have this special extra number between 1 and 46. So you pick those. So what's the probability that you would get all of these right? Yes. It's extremely large. 175 million. 175 million. But here's another interesting improbability. This improbability also applies to any string of numbers that fits this. So whatever the winning numbers happen to be, it doesn't matter. You see on the news these are the winning numbers. Any string of numbers is really improbable. That you got that specific string of numbers and not another string of numbers is extremely improbable. I know most of us don't think that way, but they go, whatever, yeah, that's just the numbers. They happen to be. But whatever that string is actually really improbable. Once again, that it was that particular string of numbers, whatever it was, and not another string of numbers. It's very, very improbable. You might think about this. This is probability theory. Given this is extremely improbable, still we have no issue believing that that particular string of numbers that won is that particular string of numbers that won. We have no problem in believing that, even though it's highly improbable that, once again, that particular string of numbers was the winning string. Okay? So you might have to think about this. Once again, this is so common sense, sometimes it's hard to think that who could have an issue with this, right? But it is improbable. Another issue as well, similar to the ones you guys raised. Let's say one day we read this, baby being born in space. Notice none of us would have any issue with this, even though it's extremely improbable according to Hume. What do I mean? The uniform testimony of humanity is people are born on Earth. That's it. They're not born anywhere else. The idea that someone's born somewhere else is extremely improbable. Think about the testimony of humanity, of how many people, billions upon billions, that have been born on the Earth. And now you're telling me someone's born in space. I'm not going to believe it. Highly improbable. The wise man hedges his bets on the more probable. People are born on Earth. once again, this doesn't make sense. Of course we, I mean, of course we want to know the details, but in principle, we wouldn't have any issue with this, even though it's highly improbable, right? And this is something that you guys mentioned, the idea that new events are extremely improbable, right? Human beings flying, even aided, extremely improbable, because humans have never done that prior to the Wright brothers, right? They, you know, jump off things and go straight down. Well, they happen, though. And though initially, of course, we might want, you know, details and such, they happen. The first person to slam dunk a basketball. Who knows it? Do you guys know what that is? I used this last time. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I really don't know if you guys... Okay. Any case, any new event is extremely improbable at first, given the testimony of humanity. What is the testimony of humanity? People shoot a certain way. They don't slam dunk. Right? So the first person to do that, extremely improbable. Right? What have all the other players done in the history of the NBA? They shoot, jump shoot. They don't slam dunk. What is that? A wise man hedges his bets on the more probable. He jump shot it. You just didn't see it right. That's the more probable. He didn't slam dunk it. Something like this. But once again, we have no issue with this. Right? Sometimes, regularly in slam dunk contests, people are doing new novel things. We have no real issue with it, even though it's being extremely improbable, according to Hume. So, once again, we don't have this premise, we don't have the conclusion. So, this is Hume's argument with regard to the incredibility, right? And when you argue in a probabilistic fashion, arguably, doesn't make sense. There are many things that were quite rational in believing that turn out to be quite improbable. But once again, we have no issue with, really. Given this, I don't think 4 follows. I have no problem with the rest of the premises, but I don't think 4 follows. Given that, I don't think the last follows either. Okay? All right, do you guys have any questions on anything that we went through? Try to make it as simple as possible, but if you have questions, we can get, you know, a little bit more sophisticated on any particular point. Any questions on anything we went through? Miracles in general, or...
Wouldn't a miracle be more based on possibility rather than probability?
Like how?
Like, it's possible for a baby to be born in space. We can go into space, so we know that it's possible. Women could be pregnant and give birth in space.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the possibility of a person coming back to life after they die and their cells are all dead, that's, like, not really possible.
But how would we know that's not really possible? Well, how do we know scientifically proven? I mean, the point is, for Hume, it's testimony from scientists. Everything is testimony, right? It's testimony that we don't see people dying and rising that often, right? So it's all about testimony. So, and actually what you mentioned, I think, is actually really important. The claim isn't that people naturally rise from the dead. That's not the claim. The claim is that for no reason whatsoever, people rise from the dead. I think that's quite improbable. That's for me, is a bit hard to believe. What's the claim? God raises people from the dead. So essentially tied to at least the Christian theistic account, the miracle account, is God's existence. So if it's possible that God exists, it's possible that miracles can happen. That's all you need. Possible that God exists, it's possible that miracles can happen. Okay? Granted, you can disprove God's existence and thereby, you know, shut out miracles. That's going to be difficult, though. Okay, I'll grant you that it's possible you can do this. You can attempt to disprove God's existence. And in so doing, you shut the door on miracles. I'll grant you that. But the question is, can you do that? Can someone do that? This is going to depend on cases, right? People have tried to make a case for God's non-existence before. Atheists try to do this. They try to justify this, especially with the problem of evil, right? So they say God's nature with regard to you Christians and how you describe God is inconsistent with evil in the world. But we know evil exists, therefore God doesn't exist. Okay, something like this. And if God doesn't exist, miracles can't happen. Okay? But once again, like I said, given it's possible that God exists, miracles are possible. That's all that's necessary. Right? So I would disagree with Hume that, by the way, that miracles are violations of natural law. I don't think that they are. So I don't think you have to take miracles as violations of anything. So I disagree with that. But nice. Okay. Any other questions? Good. That is true, but what I don't want to do is be anachronistic. So I don't want to inject any of this 20th century or 21st century understanding of what we have of this or that into Hume. So the way Hume talks, this is what natural law is for him, uniform testimony. And we might distinguish and say, well, no, testimony is different from scientific law and this and that. But Hume would just say, well, that's how you get law. People do experiments and they observe, and you gather people's observations. So he'd say they're the same thing, essentially. So I'm kind of trying to stick with what Hume says here. So, yeah, but in principle, I have no problem separating the two. Hume wouldn't, though. What is scientific law? Testimony gathered up. That's all it is. So, okay. Anyone have anything? Go ahead.
When it was Hume, what time period was he written in?
1600s. Sure, yeah, we do. Because Hume is the most well-known, and people follow Hume. Yeah. Hume is... I don't know of anyone who has made a stronger case like Hume has done. So people that have followed Hume, I don't think they've done as good a job as Hume has done in making his style of case. So... not only do I think he's the best proponent, I mean, he is the first. Anyone that does philosophy, when they criticize miracles, they go to Hume. That's just a fact. So if you know Hume, it's helpful to deal with skeptics. Everyone's going to go back to Hume. All the skeptics trace their skepticism back to Hume. They love Hume. So that's why, as a Christian, it's really important to know his philosophy, to know how to deal with it, how to answer it and such, because everyone references Hume. Anybody have anything else?
How come you didn't define miracle?
Because I wanted to stick with Hume's definition.
But his definition is a rare occurrence.
The definition, a violation of a natural law. That's what a miracle is. So my definition isn't a violation of a natural law. What is a miracle for me? It's an event that cannot be explained by prior naturalistic causes. So here's what I mean by this. That means they come in two kinds. That's a natural event with unnatural timing, or an unnatural event. So, it's raining kind of heavily right now. What if I say, you know, rain, stop, and the rain stops? Notice the event of the rain stopping isn't in and of itself unnatural. Rain stop all the time. They start, they stop all the time. Well, what's special about it? The timing. And let's say I say rain start. And it starts, and I say rain stop, and it stops. Notice, once again, rain starts and stops all the time. Those are natural occurrences, but the timing is unique. The timing is special, right? So when Jesus calms the storms, it's not like storms have never been calmed before. It's the timing that's unique, right? So that's one instance of a miracle, right? It's just an event that can be very naturalistic in its description, but the timing is unique. Another is something that seems to be, strictly speaking, unnatural. The idea, for example, someone dying and rising from the dead, right? That doesn't typically happen. So that would be an example of another type of miracle. But both, I think, require divine intervention. If I could do that, you know, this and that, I got something going on. I got something supernatural going on, right? If I could do that. In the same way someone's rising from the dead, something supernatural is going on. Okay, so that's how I would define a miracle. But I just wanted to stick with how Hume defines it, not to muddy up things, so you have to remember two different definitions, you know. So we just start off with Hume, violation of a natural law, something like that. So, yeah. Okay. Anything else?
Bye. I was going to say, you were going interesting places when you were talking about dreaming and going into other people's dreams. Have you ever heard of the term dream weaving? That's manipulating other people's dreams, but there are other ways of telling it whether you're dreaming or not. The totem thing was kind of a weird example. I never heard that before. My favorite one is, well, for example, right there, we could all read that. If we were all dreaming, that would all be gibberish nonsense. Another one is...
Let's talk about that. That's interesting. So we get a lot of the dream philosophy comes from Descartes, and this was his issue: how can you distinguish between waking and dreaming? Right? Because if you can't, then you can't be justified in what you know. Now, Descartes wasn't like Hume. Hume wanted to be a skeptic. Descartes was a Catholic. He wanted to be a good Catholic, but he thought, you know what? The foundations of prior philosophy are sort of infected, like with termites, and instead of like pulling them out one by one and putting in a new one, but then that gets a little infected, and I pull one out and put a new one, but that gets a little infected. He says, you know, I just got to destroy the foundations. And so his point was to rebuild it back up. But he employed what's called hyperbolic doubt. So this isn't normal doubt. This is doubt to like the nth extreme, right? So the question is that he posed was, well, how do I know I'm not dreaming right now? Now, you raised a good point that some people raise. They say, well, here's how. For example, when you're dreaming, a certain logical part of your brain turns off, and it's hard to, for example, do mathematics when you're dreaming. So if you were dreaming and you saw certain, you know, mathematical symbols, it'd be hard to figure that out. So that's a clue, allegedly, that you're dreaming. If you see these mathematical symbols, 3 plus this times this, but it's just really hard for you to figure it out, it's because you're dreaming. That part of your brain is turned off, right? The problem with that, just like we saw with the totem, is it begs the question. It begs the question, right? Where did you learn that information? Oh, I learned it when I was in the awake world. I learned it when I was in the real world. But that was the question to begin with. How do you know you learned that information in the real world? How do you know you didn't learn that in the dream world? How do you know that the real world isn't a fuzzy world where you can't do math? And the dream world is a world where you can do math. So the thing is, any experiment you can think about, the problem is you can dream. That's the issue. There's no experiment that you can think about that you can't dream. Given this is the case, distinguishing between dreaming and reality is difficult. And so Descartes used this criticism to build up a new philosophy. So it's very interesting. So let me just get to one more point. Well, does this leave us in total skepticism? I mean, if what I just said is true, that any experiment we can think of to distinguish between waking and dreaming, we can also dream, which is problematic, right? Well, what are we left with? Well, here's what he said. He said there's a certain proposition that's absolutely true in all instances, indubitably true. It's not affected by this skepticism, this dream skepticism. Actually, it's not even affected if you're slightly crazy or something like that. Okay? If you're slightly insane. It's not even affected by that. As long as you can understand propositions and things like this. What is this proposition that can survive this absolute doubt? He said, I think, therefore I am. This is the proposition that he starts off his new philosophy with. Why? Because it's impossible to be mistaken about existing. It's impossible to be mistaken about thinking, right? It's not possible you can be tricked about existing. If you didn't exist, there's nothing there to be tricked, okay? It's impossible that you deny that you exist. Why? Who's doing the denying? Somebody is. If nothing existed, nothing would be denying anything. People deny things. Minds deny things. So he says it's actually self-contradictory to try to deny your own existence. I don't exist. Well, you just said I, right? Conceptually, you have to exist. So this is his new foundation for philosophy. So he gets away from all the dream skepticism and things like this, and he says, this is the absolute secure foundation for my philosophy. I think, therefore I am. I have to exist, and I have to be a thinking thing. And no one can trick me about that. It's not like I'm a thing that doesn't think, and someone is tricking me into thinking that I think. You can't trick a rock into thinking that it's thinking when it's not. I think. Even if I'm deceived, I'm thinking. I exist and I think. So this is the firm foundation for his new philosophy.
Who's new philosophy is that?
This is Descartes, René Descartes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Is one of you guys? Okay, good.
His way about answering his first question was by throwing it out the window.
Who?
Descartes. Because his first question was, am I in reality? And he didn't answer that. All he did was be like, oh, I think therefore I am. But that has nothing to do with the, like, the original premise.
Well, what he tried to do was to see if anything could survive his radical doubt. So that's what he was trying to do. And he found one thing. And from there, he builds on other things. But that was his whole point. Can anything survive radical doubt? For example, the idea that a sun exists outside right now. Well, if I'm dreaming, there's no sun that exists. If I'm dreaming, there's no room that's here. And if I'm dreaming, maybe all that family history I think I have, I don't have. So he says, is there anything that can survive that? And he says, yes, this one thing. Like I said, even a lunatic, as long as they can understand propositions, can think, I think, therefore I am. That's secure. That's absolutely indubitable. Like I said, self-contradictory to deny it. So that's what he thought. So, and I think it's the case, too. I think it's absolutely undeniable. So, yeah. Okay. Any other questions? It's about time, but any other questions? Okay, I know we got off on a tangent, but it's fun sometimes. All right, guys, it looks like our time's up. If you guys have any more questions, go ahead and talk to me. But that's it. Thanks a lot.